There's all sorts of ways to listen to BCFM Radio. Online at bcfmradio.com. On our free-to-download app from your app store. On digital, just search for BCFM on your DAB radio. Across the city on 93.2 FM. And now on smart speaker, just ask yours to play BCFM Radio. Your award-winning community radio station for Bristol. Online, on app, on digital radio, on smart speaker, and all over Bristol on 93.2 FM.
I'm going to tell you, when it comes to government and underhanded work, the mob, they're kindergarten. They're kindergarten. I might upset a lot of people in the family saying that, but they're kindergarten when it comes to working with the government. They're the goldfish in the shark's pond.
To BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A million-man march in Baghdad today, but nothing whatsoever about it on the BBC or the website. Iraqis are demanding the Americans and the coalition, that's the Brits too, leave the country now. Also, the CIA has been spying on Julian Assange and his legal team. The judge is married to one of Britain's top military people. The whole trials are set up. How can the judgment stand? Showdown between Greta Thunberg and Donald Trump at the Davos summit, which Boris has banned his cabinet from going to. He doesn't want these rich and powerful lobbying them. Prince Charles is trying to mediate between Trump and Greta. Where are Monty Python when you need them? Thomas Markle this week told all on a TV documentary along with Meghan's drama teacher from school. Not looking good for the headstrong Sussexes. Miles Copeland speaks. He's the former CIA station chief in Cairo in the 1950s. Now the coup. He orchestrated back in 1949. Talking about going back that sort of distance in time, on the trail of Martin Bormann, my little obsession, we go to Buenos Aires in 1972 to see what local people there believe Bormann, whether they believed he'd been found or not, what his fate should be. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, Detective Superintendent Liz Hughes on Avon and Somerset's insistence that people should still come forward to the police with accusations of child sexual abuse after the whistleblower Carl Beach ended up going down for 18 years. Plus more on the alleged fraud by Lloyds Bank against their customers, the Castle Park branch, the business support alleged so-called unit. You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download it right now from dialectradio.co.uk. But Martin, we start where the BBC don't, which is over in Iraq and Baghdad particularly, a million people marching to Baghdad really to send a very, very clear signal that it's not just the parliament what wants the coalition, so-called coalition, the illegal war coalition back from 2003 out of their country.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously I haven't seen I haven't checked the internet to see what's going on.
You haven't been watching the BBC then?
Well, I haven't been watching the BBC. I've been working all day, Tony. I've not been able to do anything. I presume it is going to be a big march because Muqtada al-Sadr, who's very Iraqi nationalist and in many ways quite hostile to the more pro-Iranian elements within the Shia community, they have buried the hatchet and there's a very clear demand that foreign troops need to leave the country. And I think Barzani, who's the Kurdish leader, has also, because they basically got help from Hezbollah, from Lebanon, to deal with ISIS. And I think there's gradually a consensus emerging in Iraq that foreign troops need to go.
The Americans apparently are seeking to carve out a Sunni state in Iraq. Is that going to wash?
Well, that's what ISIS was all about. If you remember, ISIS arrived from nowhere with brand new Humvees and all the rest of it, and the Iraqi army, which the Americans had trained, melted away, and suddenly there was an ISIS state in northern Iraq. And then, of course, the Americans said, oh, you need us to come back to deal with ISIS. Many people in Iraq, and they know an awful lot more about this than the average punter in Britain, they believe that ISIS was basically a front for Americans to come back into Iraq. And of course, the actual ground war against the ISIS was carried out by these popular mobilization units, which are part of the Iraqi armed forces, the people that the Americans carried out an airstrike.
Well, hang on,
on,
because the BBC say they're part of the Iranian armed forces.
Well, that's rubbish, isn't it? Because the fact of the matter is these PMUs are part of the Iraqi armed forces.
Now, these are the units which apparently caused all the Americans to get so upset that they decided that they were going to assassinate Soleimani the other week.
Well, the Americans carried out...
By the way, they're now threatening to assassinate his successor.
Yes, they're threatening to assassinate. Pompeo was saying, "This is just we didn't just assassinate Soleimani. We want all of our enemies to know that we think it's okay to assassinate you under any circumstances." Just one simple point. That is illegal, completely illegal under international law. We know that the CIA have been assassinating people for years. Patrice Lumumba was assassinated by the CIA and MI6 in the 1960s.
But why do the Americans need to care about the law if they're powerful enough to take these people out?
All right, well, if they're going to say there's no law, then there's no law. And that means that they can't actually say that you're breaking the law and you've got to obey the law. If there's no law, there's no law. And therefore, of course, Nasrullah, who heads Hezbollah in Lebanon, he made a speech the other week, and he said, well, we could try and assassinate people on the other side of a similar level to Soleimani. But of course, in actual fact, Trump's head isn't worth Soleimani's shoe. So we're certainly not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to drive the US military and their allies, the Irish Guards, for example, who are based outside Baghdad, out of the Middle East. They're either going home voluntarily or they're going home in body
bags.
I mean,
they're unwelcome guests in that country. It's quite obvious with the people and the parliaments are telling them to go. So is it feasible for unwelcome guests to stay so long? Or any longer?
It's a question of, you know, the Iraq is quite clearly occupied. And what al-Mahdi, the Prime Minister of Iraq, said in the vote, when the vote was taken to unanimously by those who turned up for the forces to leave, he said, I went to, this is all, it's all available on the internet. We can put a link up on our show page later if people...
At thisweek.org.uk.
Yeah, what he said in the parliament was, I went to China in September last year, September 2019, and I signed a deal with them to develop Iraq's oil industry. I came back from that meeting and I got a direct call from Donald Trump, who said, you're not to do that. We are going to develop your oil industry and we want 50% of the profits. And I said, well, we're not doing that. We're an independent country. It's our oil. We want to do a deal with the Chinese. They're offering us a better deal. And Trump said, you're not going to do that, because what will happen, there will be protests against you. That's what he said. And he said, I will. And then there will be snipers. And Mahdi said there will be marine snipers. He said marine snipers, that's the word he used. And they will shoot both protesters and police officers. And we will force you out of power.
Well, you didn't just say that, Martin. He also, apparently, according to the speech that Mahdi gave in the Iraqi parliament, he said that they also threatened to kill me and the defence minister.
Yeah. Well, what happened was the protests emerged exactly as predicted.
It sounds like the Chicago mob is in the White House.
It's very like what happened in the Maidan Square in Kiev, what happened in Tahrir Square in Cairo, and what happened in Caracas in 2002. So what happens is protesters march into the streets because, basically, if you've got lots of resources, you can mobilise protests, and there's usually things to protest about. Then... there was lots of people killed, but from what al-Mahdi was saying, that wasn't just random. People were being killed by third force elements. Yeah, you had a third force operating in the run-up to the South African elections in 91. Nobody really knows what's going on, and he said all of this in the parliament. And he said, when I started talking about this, Trump then turned to me and said, if you carry on talking about this third force, in other words, he's been threatened privately, and when he came out publicly, he said, we're going to kill you. But al-Mahdi's put all this on the record. Good for him. And in actual fact, that is what should be reported by the BBC In this country. Okay. That's what's going on. That's our allies.
Well, it's going on right now over in Iraq. The Million Man March was called by Muqtada al-Sadr. Now, he's been around ever since the 2003 invasion, hasn't he? In fact, he had his own newspaper, I believe, which was shut down.
Well, he's been... I mean, obviously, he's inherited his political position from his father, who was killed by Saddam Hussein. And at first, the Americans decided that they were going to squash him, and he's not actually pro-Iranian at all. In actual fact, his politics are pro-Iraqi. So in terms of Iraqi politics, he's regarded as somebody rather hostile to Iranians. But he's also a Shia. And basically, the Americans tried to crush his political movement. And at that point, the Mahdi army started killing US soldiers. And they weren't being helped by the Iranians. Don't forget, they're actually quite hostile to the Iranians. They were killing American soldiers because, as the majority community in Iraq, they don't want the Americans to be there. And they made it clear. And al-Sadr, I think, is pointing this very, very sensibly. He's saying, we're not just going to have a mad rush to kill Americans. We're going to do this politically. We're going to kick them out politically, and we're going to go through every stage necessary to kick them out politically. They're not. They've been given 1 year to get out, and they're saying if they're not out by the end of that year,
well, this is not
then
what,
we're going to declare war.
This is not what Muqtada al-Sadr is saying. Signs carried by Iraqis reading the 1920 revolution expelled the English occupiers out of Iraq. The 2020 revolution will end the American occupation in Iraq. They gathered at Tahrir Square to demonstrate against US forces inside the Middle Eastern country tonight.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, they're trying to find a way to force the Americans out without massive bloodshed. Don't forget, they've got no air cover.
It may be that he hasn't reached a million people, but there's certainly many thousands there. More, in fact, many more than were in Iran, in Tehran, which the BBC did report. So there's a lot of... it's pretty obvious something going on here with some marches. Some protesters are reported. Other marches, other protesters are not. And it's very clear.
Exactly. I mean, basically, if you watch mainstream media, you're getting a very partial and biased view. I mean, the sort of things that the Americans have been coming out with, Pompeo saying that Soleimani was involved in the 9/11 attack. Now, nobody at all believes that the Iranians had anything to do with the 9/11 attack at all. It was carried out by Sunni Muslims, probably in cahoots with the deep state in the US, but let's leave that aside. It certainly had nothing to do with Shia Muslims from Iran. So why they imagine that they can put that sort of malicious falsehood out and expect to be taken seriously by serious people is extraordinary. But of course, many people out there don't even know that there's a difference between Sunni and Shia Muslims. They're all just Muslims, they're the bad people.
So are the Americans
going to
get their Sunni state in Iraq? What do you think?
Well, there's not going to be a Sunni state in Iraq because the Sunnis are a minority. What you need in Iraq is a non-sectarian state which reflects the genuine political forces that are at work there. And ISIS...
Well, it's not for the whole country that they want this. It's just for the area around Anbar.
Yeah, well, I mean...
They want to have a separate state.
Yeah, well, I mean...
Now, of course, this is all part of that whole idea of balkanizing the Middle East.
That's right. That's right. I mean, the grand strategy of the US and the Israelis has been to balkanize.
So what would happen if the Americans were forced to pull out? Because that might put a bit of a spanner in the works for the plans for the Middle East.
Well, I mean, what would happen is they'd have to withdraw from Syria because, of course, the US military in Syria is supplied via Iraq. The Iraqis, and they're saying, well, you can't fight ISIS on your own, you've got no air cover. But the Iraqi government said, well, we could just invite the Russians to give us air cover.
Even though Trump was elected to get out of the Middle East, he's tried several times and failed. What are the pressures on Trump to stay there then? Why is it that he's staying there?
Well, there are two things. One is that he's found it very difficult to pursue any policy that the Pentagon doesn't want. I've been reading how he was taken to the tank in the Pentagon and he was lectured by the generals and he didn't like it. On the other hand, the way they've got to him is by saying, we went to war for the oil. We want that oil. And of course, Trump understands that. He's got the idea that the Iraqis should be grateful to the Americans for putting Saddam Hussein in power in 1969, for stealing, for supporting them during the Iran-Iraq war and all the rest of it, for calling them to uprise against Saddam and then allowing the Republican Guard to repress them. The Iraqis do not feel well disposed towards the Americans. The Americans, on the other hand, believe that the Iraqis owe them something quite extraordinarily, and they're saying that, well, you've got to pay us to be here. If we remove our air base, you've got to pay to
live. It's echoes of Jim Jattras last week, isn't it? But basically, Washington controls things, and you just got to do as we tell you.
Well, that, in other words, if you go back to the Thucydides or Thucydides, the Peloponnesian War, the strong do what they want and the weak endure what they must. But at the same time, of course, so the idea that there's some kind of moral crusade to make the world safe for democracy is an absolute farce.
So who's
going to
be the next
it?
Person that the or next world leader or military leader that the Americans assassinate then?
Well, we don't know, do we? But we can guess. There's, you know, they're basically saying that people would love perhaps to kill Putin. And don't forget that Putin's driver was, his favourite driver was driving through Moscow, and then suddenly his car veered onto the other side of the motorway, and he died. And that was sending a message.
Maybe he just
fell
asleep at the wheel, eh?
Yeah. And just like what's his name in Los Angeles, whose car was probably
Michael Hastings.
Hastings.
Well, this sort of thing can happen. Which leads us nicely on, actually, to talk about Julian Assange, because it's Assange that is the one journalist in the world that's really revealed through his Vault 7, I think it was 3 years ago, that the United States, the military, the CIA, etc., do intend and certainly are preparing to use the ability to hack vehicles, whether they be trains, locomotives, whether they be cars or aircraft, in order to assassinate people and make it look like an accident. Now, he revealed that as an absolute policy of the CIA, and yet he's rotting in jail in London.
Well, I mean, I think what's happening now is that the mask is coming off. They're basically openly threatening to assassinate people and saying, yes, we do assassinate people, so be afraid, be very afraid. I mean, in the past, people kind of knew this was going on, but they presumed that it would be done in a deniable way. We're now moving to openly saying, you mess with us, we will assassinate you. And, of course, there's no legal basis for this whatsoever. It actually, this sort of thing that people eventually turn around to say to Adolf Hitler, like, you've had your go. You can't play anymore. We're not going to let you play
anymore.
Okay,
unidentified drones have attacked a militia base on the Iraq-Syria border. That's either US or Israeli. So, and also, because of course this is carrying on. It's not as if this guy has just been assassinated. That's the end of the story. These continuing drone attacks are not being really reported because they seem to be, it's just another one. And also, US general is saying that US troops in Iraq are facing more threats from these militias than they are from ISIS. ISIS is not really much of a threat anymore.
Well, ISIS has been dealt with primarily by the popular mobilisation.
It almost seems as if the Americans are on ISIS's side.
Well, of course they are. I mean, as we've got internal documents showing that they were more than happy for ISIS to appear, first of all, to try and get rid of Assad. And, of course, we know that ISIS was backed by Saudi Arabia and by Qatar and by the Western powers. The White Helmets, funded by the British taxpayer, were basically a PR operation for al-Qaeda outfits like the al-Nusra Front inside Syria. And of course the relationship between these Wahhabi terrorists, the Takfiri terrorists, and the Western intelligence services goes back to the 1980s, when all the heroin was flooding into Britain to fund the war against the Red Army in Afghanistan, and the madrassas were all being funded by the Saudis, and all these young terrorists were being trained up by our special forces. That's how long that's been going on. And the idea that they are a pretend enemy. And in actual fact, they are our allies. And of course, people in the Middle East are a lot smarter than the average punter here, who, you know, doesn't even watch Victoria Derbyshire, never mind listen to this show.
Good call, because the sort of journalism on the national level is really not looking into this. I mean, for example, what's been going on over in Libya, we've had several rounds of peace talks. Haftar, who is it's really difficult to know exactly what's going on there, but a much more popular leader than the UN-sponsored government. I mean, in a way, you've got a similar sort of situation than you've got in Yemen, where you've got a UN-approved leader that most of the country seem to want to get rid of.
Well, when you say UN approved, what you mean is
the
UN Security Council has got the Chinese and the Russians on it. They've not approved these people. What you're talking about is the manipulation of the name UN by allies of the United States and, of course, Britain. We're the little poodle in the room.
Okay, sorry about that. But so why is it that somehow these leaders are being talked about as UN approved, even if they are actually not popular and most of the people in the country want to get rid of them?
Well, it's a way of trying to spin things, isn't it? I mean, Dag Hammarskjöld, who was the head of the UN, was assassinated by the CIA and MI6 in the Congo. There's been a BBC Two documentary about it. It's pretty clear that's what went on. So the idea that we don't do this sort of thing is absolutely absurd. We've been doing it for years and years and years. We're going to talk in a minute about what's happening in 1949. Nothing has changed. If anything, it's got worse. And of course, the idea that we are the good guys, sometimes we make mistakes, but basically we're good and we're trying to help the world, and there's all these evil people trying to stop us, is absolutely laughable.
So you've got Haftar in Libya and the Houthi rebels in Yemen, both of whom seem to be doing very well, actually, in terms of... it's now, apparently, in just looking at an article about Libya, Haftar is now threatening to target civilian planes. So it seems like these peace talks have come to nothing. Is Khalifa Haftar, the head of the self-proclaimed Libyan National Army, a former CIA agent, apparently. He was continuing his attempt to take over Libya militarily with an eye towards seizing the capital of Tripoli from the government of National Accord. Now, this is the UN-approved government. With attention turning again to fighting in and around Tripoli, Haftar has announced he's imposing a no-fly zone in Tripoli and surrounding area, threatening to target civilian planes.
Well, I mean, he's saying we're going to impose a no-fly zone. That's not saying he's going to target civilian planes. I don't suppose there's many civilian planes flying around in this situation. What's happening in Libya is it's kind of a rerun of Syria. Libyan terrorists, which was funneled into Syria via Turkey, Libyan Islamic Fighting Group people.
I mean, is this sort of civil war?
Hakim Belhaj. They're all being funneled back into Libya.
This sort of civil
because they're being driven out of Syria by the Syrian army.
This sort of civil war. It does seem to suit the West quite nicely, doesn't it? Because it means that they're able to deny that territory to others and, in fact, maybe bring in the military to take the oil.
Yeah, before the overthrow of Gaddafi, the Chinese had 30,000 nationals working in the Libyan oil industry. They had to put them on a ships and take them all home. And the massive investments that China had made in Libya over many years to help develop the country, all for nothing, because it's all been taken over. Or basically, the West has not been able to actually control the situation, but at least to stop the Chinese having any profit from it. And, of course, all the Libyans' gold reserves, they had massive gold reserves, flown out of the country and disappeared inside the United States, as the gold reserves of Ukraine were also taken and disappeared inside.
It's like the whole thing is another one of these divide and ruin. So we've got a divide and ruin situation going on in Libya too now, where actually ordinary people are going through absolute hell because someone somewhere has decided that they want to deny that country to anybody, any other superpower. We just want to make it so difficult and impossible to operate there that everyone will have to run away.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Chinese are planning, as you know, to sort of carry out a kind of Marshall Plan for the developing world. That's what they'd like to do with the resources that they've built up through their, you know, careful management over the last few years, and the Americans are determined to frustrate them. And the Russians, of course, have turned their country around from being a basket case into being a serious contender, and they're not going backwards either. But of course, the only way for the empire, the Anglo-Zionist empire, if we can call it that, because that's what it is, to prevent...
Well, that's what the Saker calls it.
Well, that's what I call it as well. It's pretty clear what the axis of evil is. I mean, it's the United States, Britain and Israel, isn't it?
He's a former UN advisor, isn't he? I think he was originally Russian. He now lives in Florida.
Well, I think he's actually Swiss national, actually. But anyway, it doesn't matter. People look at the Saker, Vineyard of the Saker, very good analysis on there. There's plenty of good analysis out there on the internet, but of course it's not making its way onto mainstream media, which have basically give a kind of Mickey Mouse view of the world, where there are sort of good guys with white hats and bad guys with black hats, and it's either very confusing or we're given a very simplistic analysis. What's fascinating about what's happening in Libya is it's turning into an international conflict, with the Turks supporting the transitional government, the Egyptians supporting Haftar, everybody's lining up. And so, just like Syria, it's going to turn into an international confrontation. And
isn't an accident, is it? I don't think it's not an accident.
Of course, it's not. Nothing happens by accident, does it?
When David Cameron went into Libya and has this great sort of "oh well, we've won" kind of thing, we've got rid of Gaddafi. The idea was to turn that place into complete chaos, destroy most of the country, and then have Western companies come in to try and rebuild it. A bit like what happened in Iraq,
exactly,
and Syria.
Exactly. So, in other words, that's exactly the and if they can't rebuild it, they've at least prevented other people from profiting from it, yeah? That's the minimum thing. Gaddafi was trying to do was develop the Libyan gold dinar, which would have been an alternative to the dollar. They had massive reserves of gold, which they built up because they basically used their oil wealth wisely.
They built a massive water system.
Yeah, like a huge canal.
The man-made river.
Yeah. That was all bombed to pieces by the RAF.
Just going a little bit north of there, the Turks, apparently, this has come out this week, and the first time I've seen it anyway, denied the NATO countries, NATO, any kind of base in the Black Sea. So even though NATO is quite friendly with Ukraine and other countries which border on to the Black Sea, the Turks have said, well, basically, if you build a naval base there, we're going to blockade Istanbul and you won't be able to bring your ships in and out.
Well, that's because Erdogan and Putin have been talking. And, of course, Putin was in Israel this week for the Yad Vashem Memorial of Auschwitz. Putin is talking to everybody in a reasonable kind of saying, look, we can cut a deal here. Trump is going around saying, if you don't give us your oil, we're going to kill you. You can imagine who's actually making more progress in the long run.
And the Polish Prime Minister didn't go, did he? Because he was denied a chance to speak. Don't you think that's a little bit of a faux pas by Netanyahu?
Well, I think what's happening between the Israelis and the Poles is that the right wing in Poland really resent the Israelis pointing the finger at them about the Holocaust. And the right wing in Israel have never liked the right wing in Poland because of the basic anti-Semitism that they find there. And it makes me laugh. These right wing fools deserve each other. The problem with being a right winger, Tony, is that the people right wingers hate most are other right wingers.
Well, I think you're probably saying the same about the left wing, actually. Looking at all the catfighting going on in the Labour Party.
But in principle, the left are supposed to be in solidarity with each other. I know it doesn't work out like that. The Chinese and the Vietnamese have fought.
You've got the Socialist International and you've got the Fascist International.
Yeah, but at the same time, the Fascist International has got a fundamental problem, which is that being racist as they are, they can't get on. Yeah. I mean, frankly, the right wing in Ukraine is anti-Semitic, even though the Israelis are supplying them with weaponry.
Well, what about in Poland?
Well, the right wing in Poland is traditionally anti-Semitic, no doubt about it. That doesn't mean all right wingers are anti-Semitic, but traditionally they were. And the right wing in Israel is traditionally anti-Muslim, and they definitely are. I don't think there's much doubt about that.
So, ultimately, do you think the Chinese are going to get a bit of a foothold in Iraq? Will the Iraqi people and the parliament allow China to have some sort of rights?
Well, that's what they would like to do. Because basically the Chinese are saying we will actually give you a better deal than the Americans have got their boot in your face and saying you should have that what Trump is demanding is 50% of the revenues from the oil. And basically that's not nowhere in the world is that an acceptable kind of split. It's not been an acceptable split for years now. And basically these natural resources belong to the people in the countries concerned. And it may take them longer to develop them themselves than to have the Americans come in and do it for them. But on the other hand, at the end of the day, that stuff's theirs and they've got a long term. I mean, the country that's been wrecked as much as Iraq is going to take a long time to rebuild. There's no rush.
I mean,
you've just got to approach it systematically.
Are the Americans going to get away with what they're doing and trying to do in the Middle East and the Israelis? I mean, because the only journalist, it seems to me, that's really made a dent in the US credibility, made a massive difference, is Julian Assange. Further detailed evidence has been produced in a Spanish court this week that the CIA systematically and illegally recorded conversations between WikiLeaks founder Assange and his lawyers and all other visitors. Well, whilst he was trapped inside Ecuador's London embassy before he was dragged out and arrested last April to face extradition to the US. Spanish newspaper El País yesterday reported that three people who work for the Spanish security company UC Global SL testified as protected witnesses in Spain's High Court, the Audiencia Nacional, that the company is head David Morales handed over all the surveillance material to the CIA. Testimony is another devastating exposure of the decade-long conspiracy conducted against Assange by American, British and Australian governments and their collaborators in Sweden and Ecuador. I mean, pile this on top of the fact that he's got the wife of a senior military person's as his judge. I mean, what is going on with Assange? Is there any chance that he'll be released? Because it's obviously a complete miscarriage of justice, which most of the London journalists seem to have just ignored or forgotten about.
Well, I mean, what's happened to Assange is a complete violation of Magna Carta, which was signed in 1215. And there it is, happening in open... If you talk to sort of, you know, people who listen to the mainstream media, they've all got this vague idea that he's a bad person, but they can't actually explain why he's bad. But they've just kind of picked up that he is bad. In actual fact, of course, he's done nothing wrong. He's a journalist. He's reported some of the most important stories to be broken. The New York Times and The Guardian have sold lots and lots of copies on the back of stuff that they did with him, and then they've turned around and said, oh, he's not one of us. Absolutely disgraceful.
We've just heard today that he's been moved finally out of solitary confinement. I mean, the idea of putting him in solitary confinement is almost as if he's some kind of maniac terrorist that's going to kill somebody. No, he's a journalist.
Yeah, well, I mean, I understand that you've got a motion coming to NUJ conference about this, Tony. Perhaps you could, you know, enlighten the listeners about that.
Well, not really, because it's just to bring it up and discuss whether or not the journalists around the country should be commenting on it more. That's a long time, though. That's in April, and I imagine there'll be quite a few people from around the country speaking on it. But, I mean, this whole business with Assange just strikes me as incredible, particularly that, I mean, it seems like they've torn up the rule books with court cases. You can't have somebody who's quite obviously got skin in the game as the judge.
This is our country, and it's our shame that that he's being treated in this way. And as an English person... I'm deeply offended.
Okay, what's your thoughts about whether anything will be done about it or not?
Well, all struggles, Tony, are massive struggles. With all the things we've been discussing, what's happening to Assange, what's happening in Iraq, what's happening in Libya. There used to be a political group in Italy which had something to do with in the 1970s called Lotta Continua, continuous struggle. That's what's going on.
So the judge has been exposed quite a long time ago, particularly her husband's links to the British military establishment. Lady Arbuthnot has received gifts and hospitality in relation to her husband, including from a military and cybersecurity company exposed by WikiLeaks. These activities indicate that the chief magistrate's activities cannot be considered separate from her husband's. Lord Arbuthnot of Erdom, former defence minister, is a paid chair of the advisory board of the military corporation Thales Group, or Thales Group, and was until earlier this year an advisor to the arms company Babcock International. Both companies have major contracts with the UK's Ministry of Defence.
Well, it's a plain conflict of interest. And don't forget, the charges against him are specious. Absolutely specious. He's going to be extradited to the US to stand trial under the Espionage Act for crimes which are not crimes in this country. And the Espionage Act has only been used very occasionally in the US. It was used during World War One to put the leader of the Socialist Party, Eugene V. Debs, in prison. And that's what it was used for. It was basically a political act brought in to crush opposition to the First World War. And it's got no basis in British law whatsoever. I find it absolutely extraordinary that both journalists and lawyers in this country think that this is somehow acceptable, what's going on.
It sounds to me like Lady Arbuthnot should be in jail, not Assange.
Oh, indeed. In actual fact, these people should not just be on the case. If there was any justice, they should be in court themselves. But what's interesting, what's happening in Spain, is that the Spanish judiciary, you know, people like Balthazar Garzón and so on, I don't know if he's involved in this case, they are now saying, we are going to put you in court. Never mind you putting Assange in court, you are the criminals. We're going to put you in court. And that is the way forward. Ultimately, you were talking earlier about, is there any rules? What can we do? There's going to be some rules. And that's what we're fighting for. That's what the Iraqis are fighting for. We elected our government. These are our rules. These are the rules. And you're breaking them. And if we found out that you've been involved, for example, in assassinations or whatever, people who order assassinations are criminals and they should be in prison. That's all.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
I was quite impressed to hear that Boris Johnson gave his cabinet the orders not to go to Davos this year. This is where the great and the good go to Switzerland. Switzerland's a funny old country, isn't it? It's where Lenin chugged away to do the Russian Revolution. They seem to make money out of all the wars, and yet they're not involved. They sort of sit up on a mountaintop in Switzerland and watch World War One. Then loads more money comes in. You sit up on the mountaintop in Switzerland, watch World War II. Even more money comes in. Funny old place, Switzerland. But anyway, let's have a look. And this is where Davos this week has been. All sorts of people there. Not the British cabinet, but Greta Thunberg has been there, and so has Donald Trump. And it's really quite an amazing confrontation. But I thought we'd start by listening to what Prince Charles had to say. Of course, he did fly there and back, you know, which is a minor criticism, really. Of course, he's going to have to. But I want to know, Martin, if you can actually make out what he's talking about here. Prince Charles gave a whole sort of speech about all this. And I wonder if you can, you know, sort of make head or tail of what he's trying to say. Obviously, he's pro-environment. But the thing is, if of course, he has another one with skin in the game because his company is involved, or it's his duchy, which is involved in this whole carbon trading business. But anyway, let's have a listen to Prince Charles now.
Do we want to go down in history as the people who did nothing to bring the world back from the brink? What good is all the extra wealth in the world gained from business as usual if you can do nothing with it except watch it burn in catastrophic conditions?
Well, I'm not sure what to make of that. But anyway, Prince Charles was exposed in the Panama Papers as being involved in this whole carbon trading process. And there he is really talking it up. I think shouldn't he really just stay away, and if he's got skin in the game there?
Well, I mean, carbon trading is fundamentally wrong. I used to be involved in the discussions about this years ago, and I worked for the New Economics Foundation, and most of the serious non-governmental...
Was it sort of started by Aubrey Mayer?
Aubrey Mayer, yeah. He was the one who was pushing this idea. And, of course, carbon...
It's in the 1990s.
Yeah. The carbon trading is a way of trying to find a market solution for the problems of, you know, fossil fuel production. And of course, the idea is that you know, poorer countries will have lots of credits because they haven't been polluting so much. Richer countries will have fewer, and then the poorer countries will sell their carbon trading stuff to the richer countries, and it will lead to a flow of money from the rich to the poor. But it's a market solution. As a socialist, I would say this: in World War II, everybody made plans for how much coal and how much oil they were going to use. And if you're going to do anything to solve any of the environmental problems, leaving aside whether climate change is caused by human activity or not, you've got to have a plan. And it's got to be a plan.
Are you saying it's not, then?
I'm not arguing about that. I'm just saying there's plenty of things we need to do, but we do not need pseudo markets to solve problems. The market economy is basically massively inefficient, even as it is, and to move it into bigger things...
I mean, some might argue the market economy is actually suicidal for the planet.
Well, it is, yes. And that's why we've got to move towards a socialist system of planning, indicative planning.
Okay, well, anyway, look, so Greta Thunberg and Donald Trump are really at opposite ends of the spectrum, so I thought we'd hear from both of them tonight, from Davos I think it was Monday or maybe last Sunday. First, from Donald Trump. Ding, ding, round one.
While many European countries struggle with crippling energy costs, the American energy revolution is saving American families $2,500 every year in lowering electric bills and numbers that people said couldn't happen. And also, very importantly, prices at the pump. We've been so successful that the United States no longer needs to import energy from hostile nations. With an abundance of American natural gas now available, our European allies no longer have to be vulnerable to unfriendly energy suppliers either. We urge our friends in Europe to use America's vast supply and achieve true energy security. With U.S. companies and researchers leading the way, we are on the threshold of virtually unlimited reserves of energy, including from traditional fuels, LNG, clean coal, next generation nuclear power, and gas hydrate technologies. At the same time, I'm proud to report the United States is among the cleanest air and drinking water on Earth. And we're going to keep it that way. And we just came out with a report that at this moment, it's the cleanest it's been in the last 40 years. We're committed to conserving the majesty of God's creation and the natural beauty of our world. Today, I'm pleased to announce the United States will join 1 Trillion Trees Initiative being launched here at the World Economic Forum. 1 Trillion Trees. And in doing so, we will continue to show strong leadership in restoring, growing, and better managing our trees and our forests. This is not a time for pessimism. This is a time for optimism. Fear and doubt is not a good thought process, because this is a time for tremendous hope and joy and optimism and action. But to embrace the possibilities of tomorrow, we must reject the perennial prophets of doom and their predictions of the apocalypse. They are the heirs of yesterday's foolish fortune tellers, and I have them, and you have them, and we all have them. And they want to see us do badly, but we don't let that happen. They predicted an overpopulation crisis in the 1960s, mass starvation in the 70s, and an end of oil in the 1990s. These alarmists always demand the same thing: absolute power to dominate, transform, and control every aspect of our lives.
So that's Donald Trump there. I think before we hear from you, Martin, let's just go straight to Greta. Ding, ding, round two.
Planting trees is good, of course, but it's nowhere near enough of what is needed, and it cannot replace real mitigation and rewilding nature. And let's be clear, we don't need a low-carbon economy. We don't need to lower emissions. Our emissions have to stop if we are to have a chance to stay below the 1.5-degree target. This is not about right or left. We couldn't care less about your party politics. From a sustainability perspective, the right, the left, as well as the center, have all failed. No political ideology or economic structure has been able to tackle the climate and environmental emergency and create a cohesive and sustainable world. Because that world, in case you haven't noticed, is currently on fire. You say children shouldn't worry. You say, just leave this to us. We will fix this. We promise we won't let you down. Don't be so pessimistic. And then, nothing. Silence. Or something worse than silence. Empty words and promises which give the impression that sufficient action is being taken. We demand at this year's World Economic Forum participants from all companies, banks, institutions, and governments immediately halt all investments in fossil fuel exploration and extraction, immediately end all fossil fuel subsidies, and immediately and completely divest from fossil fuels. We don't want these things done by 2050, 2030, or even 2021. We want this done now. I wonder, what will you tell your children was the reason to fail and leave them facing a climate chaos that you knowingly brought upon them?
Well, obviously, I'm more sympathetic to Greta than I am to Donald. That's all I will say at that point. I mean, what else is there to say?
Well, she's saying, actually, what she's saying is you've got to have a no-carbon society. Low-carbon is no good anymore.
Well, I think what you do in any political struggle is you make maximum demands, because you might be able to move something in the direction you wanted to go in. If you don't make maximum demands, you don't get anything. And I think that's you know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of continuous struggle. That's what's going on all over the world. And, you know, I would question why Greta goes to Davos, because they're not the solution, they're the problem.
Well, that's what she's making demands of those people, and she's getting a lot of sympathy. I mean, surely that's the best place to do, well, to right. lobby.
Well, I kind of agree, and then another part of my mind, I'm thinking, well, what's the point of talking to these people? They're the enemy. And, you know, that's the truth, isn't it?
What about this whole idea of no fossil fuel subsidies, no fossil fuel investment? Divest yourself from all of those. I mean, most, you know, there's quite a lot of businesses out there who are just based on fossil fuels.
Well, if you're going to do that, you've got to have a plan to get from A to B. I mean, one of the things that the IMF often demands in countries where they've got the stranglehold, like Argentina and other places, is that they've got to stop subsidising petrol. Which then, of course, that when they raise the price of petrol, that massively immediately increases the price of food, because food depends upon transport and all the rest of it, and then people riot because they can't pay for the weekly food bill. So if you're going to do that, you've got to compensate people, and that means basically the wealthy have got to foot the bill, and making them foot the bill is quite difficult when they've got all the artillery and we've got all the goodwill.
Okay, what about Trump's point about the population scare of the 1960s? The food starvation scare of the 1970s and peak oil in the 1990s. He's saying these were all just scare tactics, and exactly the same is happening now with climate change.
Well, I think what happened in all of those cases is that people raised issues which were being completely ignored by the mainstream.
Yeah, but were they really a threat and a crisis?
Well, no, they were. I mean, don't forget we've had the one-child policy in China, which has massively reduced the world's
population. That's just one country.
It's a big country, though. Nearly a quarter of the world's population live in the People's Republic of China.
But it didn't make any difference in the vast majority of the world, did it?
Well,
because of that issue, every decade,
the Chinese took steps, and that's why the Chinese population could be double what it is now, in which case there'd be half the world population.
Well, what about the food crisis then? Because, that never really materialised. Oh. Obviously, many people in the developing world have had a horrendous time, but was that any worse than, say, for example, the 1950s
and 60s? The fact of the matter is that out there in the developing world, people still die every day from malnutrition. You could perhaps look it up on the internet now. It will be in the hundreds of thousands, if not the millions, every day. Day in, day out.
Maybe they were right about both of those. And what about peak oil? There's still oil being pumped out the ground at the rate of knots.
Apart from that's why we're going to war to control what's left of it. Because there's so much oil that we don't have to fight about it. It's just popping out of the ground everywhere. That's why the Americans have invaded Iraq and won't let the Chinese develop the oil, because there's so much oil that they don't need.
I mean, isn't the whole oil question actually quite a bigger one with a complete another dimension, in that if you want to fight a world war, like, say, for example, World War III, you've got to have quite a lot of oil to win.
That's right. And so, in other words, of course, the kind of tactics that were used by the environmental movement in the 60s and 70s and so on were tactics to raise people's awareness of what was going on. The reality is that we're much more likely to die in a nuclear war because of people like Trump with their finger on the button than we are to die of climate change. But we could die of climate change as well, even if we avoid the nuclear war. This world has become an incredibly unjust place, and it's a lawless place as well.
Doesn't it happen every once in a while, just before a war?
Well, I mean, if you know anything about history, the likelihood is that we're going to have a third world war for exactly the same reasons that the First and the Second World War broke out, because capitalism is a basically unjust and unstable system and has been for 500 years. And basically, unless we either get rid of capitalism or capitalism is going to get rid of us. And of course, there's so many pro-capitalists out there who just, no, but it's produced all this wealth and all this, but it's also incredibly unstable. And of course, it's pushing. The only way to deal with this is for a Marshall Plan led by the Chinese with our cooperation. And of course, we're going to war to prevent that.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com. And leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Well, the truth is finally out about Thomas Markle, a programme on, I think it was on Channel 5 this week, documentary, very frank one, with Meghan Markle's father over in, I'm not sure if it's either in New Mexico or in Texas where he lives, which is also included some fascinating bits of insight into her, which we haven't seen before. For example, from high school drama teacher, you know, which led her into her career in films.
Thomas staged photos with the paparazzi to improve his image.
Harry said to me, if you had listened to me, this would not have happened to you. If I'd stayed in the house and kept the door locked and never spoken to anyone, this wouldn't have happened. To me, that was a very rude thing to say, especially when he knew I was laying in a hospital bed. At that point, I said to him, It's too bad I didn't die, because you guys could pretend that you're sad. And then I hung up on him. I was done. Now, that may have caused everything. I don't know. But I've not heard from them or spoken to them since. She actually got every girl's dream. Every young girl wanted to become a princess, and she got that. And now she's tossing that away for, it looks like she's tossing it away for money. Apparently $3 million and a 26-bedroom home isn't enough for them.
At the end of the day, Martin, what do you think? I mean, are you following this? What do you think of the idea of the Sussexes splitting off? Because I can't help but think that the royal family is a bit like leaving a cult, leaving the royal family. It's going to be an extremely difficult thing to do. And when you do, it's going to be very painful. And it might be that Harry is a bit of a free spirit like his mum, and he's just finding it very, very difficult to survive and to keep his mouth shut within the royal family. And that's why he's had to leave. And of course, it's going to be a very difficult process. I suppose the final question about all of this is whether Meghan Markle is really helping or not.
Well, I mean, it's almost from the sublime to the ridiculous, I suppose, is what I'd say. We're just talking about world war and all the rest of it. Now we really are talking about nitpicking things. Basically, if they want to walk away from the royal family, good luck to them. That's what I say.
The absolutely amazing side to the whole Thomas Markle business, though, is that it may even be that the Secret Services were involved in stopping phone calls going between them in order to ferment this, because it looks as if Meghan is saying she tried to call him, he's saying he tried to call her, but the calls just didn't get through, and both of them have taken it as a way of saying, well, the other person's cut me off.
Well, as you know, Tony, you've over the years explored what went on with Diana Spencer, and it's pretty clear that she was targeted by the intelligence services in various ways. So it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, well, given the proclivities of these people, given the other things that we've been talking about in the show.
Okay.
Do you trust them? I don't.
Well, certainly not, no. Anyway, I thought we'd wind up with talking. I'll put a link up anyway to that Markle programme on our show page, Thomas Markle. It really does shine a lot of light on what's been going on. Have a listen now to the Miles Copeland, because he talks here on the BBC. I mean, we're talking about the death of investigative journalism. This was back in the 1960s or 1970s. He was the CIA station chief behind the 1949 coup in where?
Syria.
Very good. So, Syrian coup.
And of course,
they've been trying to have coups in Syria for quite a long time. And in fact, this coup installed the Assad family, who are still there, who now the Americans have changed their mind. They don't like him. They want him out. So let's have a listen to Miles Copeland, the father of the Police's drummer, Stuart Copeland, who was the CIA station chief and wrote a book called The Game of Nations.
It seems to confirm from the inside many of the people's worst fears about the way in which American policy is conducted. For example, you say that all sorts of things were done in the field, for example, plotting to overthrow the Syrian government and others, without the State Department being very fully informed about what you were up to.
The State Department didn't want to be informed in that particular instance. If it had been informed, it would have to have told us not to do it.
And therefore you didn't inform it.
The State Department practically asked not to be informed in this case. We did inform the State Department, and you've read the book, you know this case where simply it was hinted to us that we had best shut up about what was happening in the country, and if Husni Zaim, the case in point, you are talking about
the Syrian case.
Yes.
We overthrew the Syrian
if
government,
Husni
yes.
Zaim wanted to have a coup, and if his intention was to get rid of the corrupt government and establish a democratic government, we should leave him alone and stay out of it.
And that was the State Department policy, but in fact, you very largely organized, directed, I mean you personally, but you're among the team who did it, organized and directed this coup.
Exactly.
Yes. And then when Secretary Dulles was in office, you say that he was taking the high road, but the working levels at the State Department and the Pentagon were well advanced down the low road. That is a totally different policy. Carrying on subsidiary policies almost totally inconsistent with the Secretary's. Do you think that's a useful way of conducting a foreign policy?
Keith, I'm not going to make a moral judgment about this. You're asking me the way things are done, and that's what my book is about. My book is not about complaining. My book is not a great outcry about how things are done wrong or right in the American government. I'm simply describing the way things are done.
Yes.
It is true. Now, let me finish. It is true that in many cases we would sit around in our attics of the State Department and we would have long discussions. Our government does not interfere in the internal affairs of a sovereign nation, and we meant that from the bottom of our hearts. And then we'd say, but in this is one case where we have to. And so we had to try to decide how to do what it was we said was against our policy to do. And we did, in fact, interfere in internal affairs of many sovereign nations. I must say we don't do it anymore. I mean, but there was a time.
I'm not asking you, see, to make a moral judgment about this. What I'm saying is that, looking over the period that you've reviewed in your book, do you think that this was a useful and successful way of conducting foreign policy or not? Do you think, in fact, this gaming business worked out and paid off?
Well, now, there are two parts of the gaming business. One part is that the main purpose of war games, peace games, business games, any of those games, is simply to predict whatever one else will do. In that regard, games have been very, very satisfactory. The other part to the game is actually to play it by making moves so as to bring about the outcome that you want. Now, in that, I would say that we've had successes and we've had failures. I would say that on balance, our government has, since the Cuban incident, our government has just about eliminated this sort of thing. I think, I have no way of knowing, I'm not in our government anymore. My feeling is that this is just about, is decided that on balance, this is a bad thing to do, and it's better to let a country stew in its own juice. If it has a corrupt leader, let them have it. It's their tough luck. The people in the country don't have what it takes to get rid of a corrupt leader, the hell with them. Let them keep him.
And so this means, really, that this whole experiment, which in many ways you describe, is a phase of policy in America, which in your view is over because it didn't pay off.
Yes, I would say so.
Thank you, Mr. Cook.
That's Miles Copeland. They're very frank there, Martin. BBC investigating, doing their job back in the 1960s, 70s, or whenever.
Well, it's extraordinary to me. I mean, anybody who's got any knowledge of history knows that the CIA organises coups. And the idea that they don't is absurd. And, of course, a lot of what they do is, strictly speaking, illegal. I'd say, well, that's always gone on. No, it hasn't. There's no reason for it to go on. And if it carries on, it's because we want it to carry on. It's got to stop.
Well, very sad to hear this week the death of Terry Jones, terrific comedian, both in sort of spiritual and political matters right throughout his time. But I will leave you with a clip, a famous clip featuring one of his best, I think, actually. And it's now time to sign off for the US-owned Comcast News at 8. Coming up, we hope, live on Facebook, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our guest in the first hour, that's Green Councillor for Redland, Martin Fodor. You'll find this show's podcast story links and comment page and our contact details at thisweek1word.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Our sister show Dialects here on Tuesday at noon, but do please join us on the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
What are all those people doing out there?
Come
on, what have you been up to, my lad?
I think they must have popped by for something.
Popped by? Swarm by, more like! There's a multitude out there!
They started following me yesterday.
Well, they can stop following you right now! Now, stop following my son! You ought to be ashamed of yourselves!
The man is
Oh!
and you can see him for 1 minute, but not 1 second more. Do you understand?
Yes.
Promise?
Well, all right.
All right, here he is then. Come on, Brian, come and talk to them.
But, Mum, Judith.
Now, leave that Welsh tart alone.
I don't really want to.
I've got one or two things to say.
Tell us both of them.
Look, you've got it all wrong. You don't need to follow me. You don't need to follow anybody. You've got to think for yourselves. You're all individuals.
Yes, we're all individuals.
You're all different.
Yes, we are all different.
I'm not.
Got to work it out for yourself.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.